Hi there, welcome back to the Cory Doctorow podcast. Finally back home and podcasting for the first time since September. As listeners will be aware, I spent 2 and a bit months abroad, first in San Francisco and then in Los Angeles and then in Melbourne, Australia, doing a wide variety of things. And so I haven't had the opportunity to podcast, but I'm back now and I'm going to catch you up on what I've been doing and a few things that are in my calendar coming up. And then I'm going to read to you a story in the Little Brother cycle, a story called Lawful Interception that came out while I was away, that is a sequel of sorts to Homeland. So I started off the trip at the end of September in San Francisco, where Little Brother was the one city, one book choice of the San Francisco Public Library System. And I did a whole string of events, school events, press events, events at the public library that were part of a much larger program that involved film screenings and guest lectures and debates and tutorials on everything from building robots to mastering cryptography for home and other use. It was a very timely time to be in San Francisco, of course, thanks to Mr. Snowden and the continuing string of revelations about surveillance that continue to pop out to this day and have really made Little Brother and Homeland far more timely than I'd ever anticipated, although, of course, I should have. From San Francisco, I went to Dallas, where I was the guest of honor at a regional science fiction convention there, a really wonderful one called FenCon, and had the opportunity to appear on panels with a number of my favorite writers and people, including the inimitable Stephen Brust and his writing partner, Skylar White, with whom he had recently written a book called The Incrementalist that I reviewed on Boing Boing and that I really, really enjoyed. And I also got the chance to sample some of the local coffee roasters and see my editor, Patrick Nielsen Hayden, and my his wife and my friend, Teresa Nielsen Hayden, as well as any number of fans and just really nice people who came out and were very helpful. And the convention committee in particular were so selfless and giving. It was really a delight to attend such a well-organized and friendly conference. And from there, I went to Los Angeles, where I had a residency at the Walt Disney Corporation at their Imagineering Department, which is the design and research and development group that designs all the theme parks. And fans of my work will know that that's an area where I have an enormous amount of interest. Unfortunately, the Disney company is very secretive, and I had to sign a non-disclosure that really limits what I can talk about here. But I can say that I spent 6 weeks brainstorming and working on and developing concepts for futuristic rides, futuristic theme parks, and also things related to content licensing and collaboration with audiences. I unfortunately can't say much more than that. But if any of it ever does bear fruit, I will certainly be out there telling you about it. And I'm going to be continuing my work with Disney and doing more consulting. I've done consulting for them in the past on the theme parks. I have a number of fans among the engineering group and the Imagineering group, as you might imagine. People love to read books about their day job. And I'm a big fan of those parks, so it's a really nice fit. And again, it was spectacular to do this work. It was a dream of a lifetime come true. Particularly, there were two nights where I got to spend a good portion of the overnight out with maintenance crews in Disneyland, including a whole night crawling around underneath the Haunted Mansion and seeing every corner of it. And I was given a washer from the Haunted Mansion. So I have an actual washer from one of the machines in the Haunted Mansion, which I got to tell you is like the talisman of my days and nights. And from there, I also did an event at the University of Southern California with Henry Jenkins and Brian David Johnson called the Three Geeks event on futurism and the uses and misuses of science fiction. And after the LA trip was over, I flew to Melbourne, Australia, where I did a series of events with the Center for Youth Literature at the State Library of Victoria. 4 days of events, 4 events, many of which were recorded and are available either on YouTube or elsewhere. And I'll put those up on Boing Boing as they send me the URLs. And so now I've been back for just less than a week. I got back, this is Monday, I got back last Tuesday. Still not quite caught up on my sleep. I've had maybe one good night's sleep since I got back, and it wasn't last night. So if I sound a bit rough, it's because I'm just not sleeping properly. And my wife has gone off to speak at an Autodesk event in Las Vegas. So I'm alone with our daughter, which is very nice. I love daddy-daughter time, but it also means that on the weekend, especially when I was a bit pooped, I couldn't just hand Posey off. So I'm a bit rough right now, but I'm hoping that things will get better this week. They always do. Eventually, sleep wins out. I did write a novel about this, my second novel, Eastern Standard Tribe, which I've previously podcast, and you can go through the archives or go to the Internet Archive, archive.org, and find all the parts of that. There are some events coming up on the 10th of December. I'm going to be speaking in the afternoon at Goldsmiths College, and then on the 11th of December, I'm flying to Edinburgh to give a presentation there at the University of Edinburgh. And those details are easily Googleable. Just type Cory Doctorow Goldsmiths, Cory Doctorow, University of Edinburgh, December, and those details will pop right up. On the 7th of February, I'm going to be in Milan for the day giving a talk. The details of that are still up in the air, but I'll give you more as they come up. But if you're in Milan or if you're near Milan and you want to come out and see me, mark your calendar, 7th of February, details TBD. And now we're on to the podcast where I'm going to read to you a story, a novella that I wrote called Lawful Interception, that was originally written for Brian David Johnson for a project with the White House Office of Technology that is still up in the air, thanks, unfortunately, to the sequester. It's been sidelined somewhat, but Tor.com published it while I was away, and I'm going to read it to you now, and it will take probably 5 or 6 installments to read, and I'll be taking some breaks over the Christmas holidays, so this might take us through to January or February. All right. Lawful Interception, a little brother story. If you grow up in San Francisco, you grow up with a bone-deep sense of what it means when the ground starts to move. Quake. The first quake I remember was just a little tremor, a 2.8, but whether it's the big one or a little dish rattler, there's no experience in the world like the experience of having the ground start to move. It's wrong, like seeing a broken bone sticking out of your skin. Wrong, like being carried upside down. Wrong, like trying to sign your name with your non-dominant hand, but times a bazillion. I was 6 when that little dish rattler knocked the knickknacks off the shelves. And as I recall, I went from sitting on the living room sofa to crouching under the kitchen table by teleportation. Or at least, I moved so fast and so automatically that I have no recollection of consciously deciding to move. When the Seneca quake hit, I was halfway from Oakland Airport to Coliseum BART on the shuttle bus, and again, wham, 1 minute we were tootling down the road, and the next, the road buckled, and the bus was tilted 45 degrees up and to the right, and we were all rolling toward the back, flailing or curling up into protective balls, and there was a sound like a burrito finding its way through the digestive system of a cow the size of a galaxy, a rumble that went right up through your skin, to your bones and joints, more felt than heard. When it stopped, the sound got louder. Car alarms, crashing buildings, screams. That wasn't a good day. I remember that day, the day the quake hit. I don't remember the day the disaster became the new normal. Like San Francisco across the bay, the city of Oakland would never be the same. When the Hayward Fault threw a tantrum, the whole liquefaction zone briefly liquefied, hence the name, and the buildings stupid humans had stuck on top of that gnarly mess of landfill and wishful thinking slid over, fell down, and fell apart. I didn't leave Oakland for a week. Ange and I had just landed at Oakland Airport after a week-long camping trip in the Nevada desert, a little pre-Burning Man event. We'd gone down to Nevada with full packs and come back with them nearly as full. The people who lived close enough to drive in had much better chow than the dried hippie treats we'd made, and they'd been cool about sharing. So when the Seneca quake hit, we dusted ourselves off and did what you do. We went to see how we could help. It was harder than it sounds. Without working phones, there wasn't any way to look at Twitter and read about what was going on out of our lines of sight. But we let the sounds and the movement of other people be our guides. And it wasn't long before we were in the rubble of a housing project, digging alongside cops, firefighters, neighbors, anyone who could make it. Everyone had stories about the things they'd seen. Fires, gas leaks, downed electrical cables. We absorbed each bit of terrible news numbly. The same numbness descended on me when I helped a woman move a broken piece of roofing and found her daughter underneath, bloody and unconscious. The first aid training I'd had kicked in, and I did what I could for her until a real medic arrived, which might have been 20 minutes, or 2 minutes, or 2 hours. The girl's blood was still on my clothes a week later when I got home to Potrero Hill in San Francisco, on the other side of the bay. In the meantime, Ange and I slept in our tent, ate our rations, and whatever we were given at the table set up by different groups, sometimes church groups, sometimes Occupy Oakland, sometimes FEMA. We never saw the Red Cross, though they raised a buttload of money for Oakland relief. Our phones started working the first night, and we called home and spoke to our parents. They were half insane with panic. They knew our plane had landed, but hadn't heard anything else. They wanted us to get home right away, of course, but the routes back into the city were all jammed solid, the ferries filled to capacity. We convinced them that we were in the right place, though in my case I had to remind my parents more than once that at 19 I was a grown-up and old enough to make my own decisions. But by day 7, I got up and realized that I'd had a hot shower in a friendly stranger's house, had made my coffee with water boiled from a working electrical outlet, had checked my email on a working phone, and I looked at Ange and she looked at me and we both said, "Time to go." We found the people we'd worked with, traded phone numbers and email addresses and long hugs, cried a little, and got on a ferry home. When we got to Fisherman's Wharf, we stopped in our tracks. "I don't want to go," I said. For more than a week, I hadn't been out of earshot of Ange. We'd fought, we'd sweated, we'd rubbed each other's sore muscles and bandaged each other's blisters. Without working network connections, we hadn't even had that companionable together-but-apart experience of sitting together but being in your own internet world, prodding at your phone. We'd just been there and together. "Don't be ridiculous," she said, but she was crying a bit. "We'll see each other again tomorrow morning, doofus. I live 2 miles from your house." She was right, but as soon as she was out of sight, fear started to gnaw at my guts. That's the one emotion I hadn't felt during the week in Oakland, fear. I'd felt brief terror when the bus started to roll, and revulsion and sorrow and exhaustion, but I'd developed a kind of blank no-space where my fear should have been. Now the space filled up, and fast. Ange was out of sight. Anything could happen. As I descended the BART stairs, the walls and roof loomed over me, and I flashed on all the tons of concrete and plaster and wood and dirt I'd shifted and imagined what it would be like if those walls were to come down on me. I didn't make it to the platform. By the time I got to the final escalator, I was in full panic attack, breathing heavily, clutching my chest, shaking. A young black guy behind me caught sight of me and said, "Whoa, you okay?" And I tried to say, "Yeah, it's nothing," but I couldn't choke out any words. There was no air in my lungs for speech. I never learned that guy's name, but he led me by the elbow back toward the turnstiles and stood with me while I tried to breathe. "Were you in the quake?" he said. I nodded. I wanted to say, "It's not like that. I was a helper, not one of the victims, but hey, no air." "That's cool," he said. "Going down there after something like that, well, I wasn't even in town that day, and I can barely bring myself to do it, you know? I mean, look at that crack in the wall." He pointed. I hadn't noticed it. It was like a zigzag of lightning forking down from the ceiling to the floor, radiating out from there. The wall had been shifted, along with the rest of town, by Seneca, but it remained standing for now. It suddenly got 100 times harder to breathe. "Oops! Sorry, do you want to get out of here?" I nodded and gulped air like a fish out of water. He let me lean on him while we went to the turnstiles, and he left me leaning on one while he spoke to the station guard, who took one look at me and buzzed us both through. He got me back up to the surface, and I could breathe again. "Thanks," I said. "Thanks a lot." I swallowed a couple of times, wiped at the sweat on my face. I'd been sweating over shovels and pry bars all week with a bandana over my face, but this was different. It was cold terror sweat, slimy and shameful. "Sorry," I said, and found that I was on the verge of tears. Jesus, I was a basket case. "Nothing to be sorry about," he said. He sounded sincere. I guess he was. He sat down next to me for a while. He was dressed like someone with a job to go to, good shoes and pants with a crease down the leg, but he sat with me for a while. "Thanks," I said, finally. "You're all right," he said, and I wasn't sure if it was a question or a diagnosis. "I'm all right," I said, because agreeing was easier than disagreeing. I don't know if I said thank you again or what, but the next thing I knew, I was walking up Stockton Street, up and up that steep hill over the summit, and down through Chinatown toward Market Street. I was dusty and dirty and sweaty and tired when I got home, but I was also comfortably numb, which was good because someone had to be calm and collected, and it wasn't my parents, who were totally freaked out at yet another incident in which I found myself in the middle of some kind of horrible problem, incommunicado, and in the line of fire. Mom and Dad finally stopped hugging me, and Dad made a ha-ha only serious joke about once being an accident, twice a coincidence, and three times a habit, and they let me go to bed. As my head hit the pillow, I would have bet $1 billion that I was going to sleep for 18 hours and then wake up, eat breakfast, and go back to bed for another 18. But when I jolted awake, covered in nightmare sweat, the numbers on my homemade Nixie tube clock swore that it was 4:12 a.m. I tried to go back to sleep, even tried my mom's trick of putting on the BBC shipping news, a droning readout of weather conditions in distant places which could knock her out like a hammer. But I was wide awake, with a totally undeserved 3-espresso jitter. I had a quick shower and brushed my teeth, and then took my beard trimmer to my face and hair, reducing everything to the number 3 fuzz I'd been wearing all summer, but which had grown out to an irritating length, hair long enough to tangle, enough beard to catch stray bits of food and to itch my face like a Brillo pad. Then I padded downstairs in a pair of boxer shorts and raided the kitchen, putting away 1/2 pound of granola with whatever nuts and dried fruits I could find on top. I had it with Dad's homemade yogurt, and it was the pure taste of home, the flavor of 100 late-night snacks wolfed down after nights spent partying or hacking. As I put the bowl in the dishwasher, I was struck by a terrible urge to throw it against the wall. It was all too damn normal. I'd been a human digging machine for a week, and now here I was, everything the same as it ever was. There were still people in Oakland who were in deep trouble, people who'd lost a lot more than the few damaged pictures and knickknacks that were sitting on our kitchen table, awaiting mending. When I'd been in Oakland, I'd been part of something bigger. I'd been helping people, and they'd been helping me. It was weird, because for all that it was a horrific disaster, it was also the chance to live like it was the first days of a better nation. A place where every person you met was your brother or sister, where you did what needed doing because it needed doing. All my life, I'd been looking for something bigger than me, something I could be a part of. Once I'd accidentally started a guerrilla army that kicked the DHS out of San Francisco. Once I'd helped put a bunch of secrets where they needed to go. Both of those things had been complicated and hard, and they'd left me feeling like I still hadn't found whatever it was that was the whole point of living. But standing with my neighbors, day and night, moving big lumps of rock and wood and dirt from where they were to where they needed to be, that had been simple. Never easy, of course, but simple. Doing what needed doing. That's what had gotten me up at 4:12 a.m., the knowledge that there was work to be done and that I hadn't been doing it. It was time to get back to work. It turns out that being semi-employed has one serious advantage. I didn't need to hit up my boss for time off. All I needed to do was stop scrounging around the startups I knew, looking for a couple of days' work writing unit tests or ramming mountains of analytic data in and out of Hadoop to figure out to the pixel where every button on a web page should live. And I was at liberty. Ever since I dropped out of university, I've been saving 10% of every paycheck in a rainy day fund, doing everything I could to forget it was there. It seemed no one I knew had a steady job anymore. If I had one penny left over at the end of the day, I should be socking it away against the day when there wasn't any money to be had. Well, the rains had come. Literally, 8 days after Seneca, the rains started. Record storms, the kind that end with flash floods and mudslides, even in the good times. These weren't good times. Parts of San Francisco and Berkeley were still boarded up and rebuilding, and Oakland, well, Oakland was Oakland. Slammed by the quake, drowned by the flood, and the part of the Bay Area where there was the least money for seismic retrofits, the earth was angry with the East Bay for sure. I'd gotten into the habit of making my parents coffee in the morning, at least on the days when I got up earlier than them. I couldn't bear to watch them drink the swill they brewed themselves. The morning I headed out to report to Occupy Seneca, I made it as extra special perfect as I could. The rain drummed on the windows, and the wind lashed the tree branches, and we sipped our coffee. Sitting by the front door were my raincoat, my pack and its rain cover, my rain boots, and a waterproof sailor hat. Dad gave me that one, something he'd been given as a joke by his students a million years before. It was a cheerful yellow sou'wester, and it made me look like I should be on a package of frozen fish fingers. It was also amazing at keeping my head dry, because, you know, sailors. Ange came in halfway through our second cup, looking crazy adorbs in her slicker and boots. I grinned like a fool as I answered the door, and she gave me a drippy kiss that left me with secondhand raindrops all down my front. "Do you like it?" she said, twirling in the front hall. "I feel like a drowned hobbit." "It works for you," I said. "Come in and get fueled up." Dirty secret. If they had to choose between me and Ange, I think my parents would choose Ange. Not in a creepy way or anything. They love me and everything, but Ange was the clear favorite in the household. The parental units lit up like Christmas lights as she came into the kitchen, fussed over her with tea towels, offered her breakfast. She grinned at me and stuck her tongue out, because she'd heard my theories about my parents' relative affection for us before, and she always made the most of it when they made a big deal of her. Two cups of coffee later, I managed to pry her loose from my parents' grasp. We suited up and set out, me riding behind her, our bikes throwing up fantails of water as we splashed up and down Potrero Hill toward the ferry docks. I knew to the stroke how much pedaling we had to do to make it up and over, and where the shallowest approaches were, but even so, we were both puffed out and red-faced by the time we boarded the ferry. Even after I caught my breath, I found my heart was still thudding in my chest. It was a good feeling, like the feeling I got just before I first kissed Ange, when I knew what was coming, but still couldn't believe it. Ange's fingers twined with mine. "Here we go," she said. We kissed again through the curtain of rain pouring down the brim of my hat and her hood. "Back to work," I said, and we squeezed. The ferry bumped away from the pier. It had only been a few days since we'd last been to Oakland, but things had sure changed in the interim. The worst-hit sites were now partitioned off with hurricane fencing bearing day-glow orange warning ribbons. When we'd left, there'd been ad hoc tables and tents with a mix of medics, chow lines, and all-purpose chill-out zones where there was Wi-Fi, power outlets, and a mixture of donated clothes, toys, and furniture. Now there were two camps, and they couldn't have been more different. On one side, in what had once been a parkette between two tall housing projects, there was the FEMA camp, where shuffling lines of people queued for hours to talk to various people sitting behind desks in smart, official-looking tents. On the other side, where there had once been a couple of basketball courts, was the Occupy Seneca operation, which was a lot less, official. Instead of burly guys in matching raincoats with FEMA and OPD in big reflective sans-serif letters on the back, the Occupy side was a patchwork quilt of people in outdoorsy high-tech nylon stuff, army surplus ponchos, improvised rainwear made out of heavy nylon shopping bags, and a guy in a huge trailing coat that seemed to have been improvised from part of a giant screen-printed vinyl advertisement. Maybe a billboard or a banner that had come down with the quake. All the colors of the rainbow were there, but they were all desaturated and waterlogged by the driving rain. They were working out of a set of yurts, camping tents, jury-rigged shelters, and lean-tos. Kids ran around between these shelters, not caring about the mud spattering up their legs and covering them to the waists. It was warmer on this side of the bed, the kind of freak weather we'd been getting more and more frequently. With the rain and the mud, it gave the whole thing the feeling of a jungle. We waded into the Occupy camp. An older African-American woman, maybe my mother's age, smiled and said hello. "Hi there," I said. "We wanted to help out, okay?" I felt weirdly tongue-tied. When we'd gone from the airport shuttle bus to the wreckages, we'd been doing what needed to be done. Now it felt like we were coming from away to provide aid, which was a bit weird, even though away, in this case, was just across the bay. "My name's Esther," the woman said. "What's yours?" Ange stuck her hand out. "Ange," she said. "And Marcus?" She pointed at me. We shook all round solemnly. Esther looked us up and down. "All right," she said. "What can you do?" I opened my mouth and then closed it. What could I do? Whatever it took, right? That's what I've been doing in that long-ago time, a couple of days back. "We were coming in from Oakland Airport when Seneca hit. We spent a week digging and helping out on this side, then went home to San Francisco a couple of days ago to see our folks and rest up. Now we're back to help out however we can." If I'd said it, it would have sounded all defensive and boastful, but when Ange said it, it just sounded like a statement of fact. I was a lucky, lucky guy. Esther nodded. Not much of that now, thankfully. Everyone's accounted for one way or another, and now they're here, we can't even go into our homes and get our things. She cut her eyes toward the FEMA camp and gave a minute shake of her head. But that was the easy part, as I'm sure you understand. Now we're figuring out where everyone's going to live, what they're going to eat, where they're going to go to school. She waved her hands at the tents. The real work. The hard work. I opened my mouth and closed it again. I hadn't really thought this far. What would you do after the digging and the rubble part was over? I felt remarkably useless. I wasn't a carpenter. I couldn't build a house. I wasn't a lawyer. I couldn't sue to make the city of Oakland provide housing. I wasn't a teacher. I couldn't run a classroom for these kids. What was I really good for when it was all said and done? Ange, though, didn't share my anxiety. We're here to work with you however we can. We're all in this together, right? Neither of us have a job. Neither of us can afford a place to live. We're one earthquake away from living in a tent. So what do we do to start doing something? Esther grinned and clapped. I could hug you. What do we do to start doing something? That's the question, isn't it? Let's see what we can find for you. Thus began the second phase of our lives in Oakland after Seneca. I washed dishes, then I carried the dishwater, a whole block to the nearest working sewer. I helped organize piles of donated furniture and clothes. I rehabilitated a hexayurt made from chipboard that had been assembled and disassembled so many times that it had gone crumbly around the edges and needed to be reinforced with strips of 1x4 lumber I cut with a handsaw, giving myself a nasty scratch or two. One of the medics checked me out and made me text my mom and make sure my tetanus shot was up to date. Then someone stuck a duct tape laptop in front of me and told me to start going through a bunch of random files where people had listed clothes and furniture needs, descriptions of lost heirlooms, offers of places to sleep, offers of donated labor, and a million other details, and asked me if I could make sense of them. 4 hours later, I was reinstalling the laptop's crashy operating system, and that was probably the moment that cemented my destiny as Occupy Seneca's IT drone. All right, I'm going to sign off for the week. There's one more thing I have to say, though. It's a bit sad. If you've listened to this podcast for a long time, you'll have heard some of Roy Trumbull's readings of my work. Roy was a legendary radio and TV engineer in San Francisco who was a fan of my work and a maker and a copy fighter, and who did me the honor of reading many of my stories for his own podcast that was called Story Spieler. He was a couple of generations older than me, 74, and he died last week after a long fight with cancer. There's an obituary for him today up on Boing Boing. It's got details of his nominated charity and some of my best wishes for his family. I hope that if you remember Roy and you were a fan of his like I was, you'll take a moment to write on his online memorial and let his family know that he is missed. Hug someone you love today, and I'll speak to you next week. Thanks.
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Sharealike US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, this song is copyrighted in the US under Seal of Copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ours, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, Ryneck Studio at gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.